Podo. You're listening to Movers and Shakers, a podcast about living with Parkinson's. The show is sponsored by Judge Nick Mostyn's Old Chambers and by the generous contributions of private donors.
Welcome, I'm Nicholas Mostyn, and we're again gathered in the pub for what I suspect may be an episode of our podcast Movers and Shakers where the laugh-moan ratio does not favour hilarity. So let's see who's here.
Rory Catlin-Jones.
Gillian Lacey-Solomar.
Jeremy Paxman.
Paul Mayhew-Archer.
Mark Mardell.
Now, this episode is about planning. Specifically, it's about planning for the moment when we shuffle off this mortal coil. Shuffling being, of course, something that we're all very familiar with, don't you think? And now Benjamin Franklin memorably said, in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. And this episode is not about taxes. So we are going to have one today about the other certainty. We have two brilliant guests who are going to be appearing today. We've got Dame Lucy Tice, who's the Vice President of the Court of Protection.
She's a judge.
She is. And Dr. Sabrina Bajwa, who's an honorary consultant in palliative care. So you can see what we're facing, the Court of Protection, palliative care. Anyhow, Dame Lucy is going to explain to us later the high importance of taking certain legal steps before we die or lose mental capacity.
We're going to get advice from a judge on how to do it.
And Dr. Bajwa is going to talk about what help we can get when we're approaching, to quote Hamlet, the frontier of that undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns. I'm not going to ask you at this point to say what legal steps, if any, you have taken. We'll have that discussion after Lucy has spoken, and it will be interesting to see who has done what, if anything. But first of all, we must all, I think, seriously face the prospect that in the future, we may well need palliative care. Now, has any of us thought about that? Rory, have you thought about that?
No, I know a bit about palliative care. I've got a great friend who's a palliative care doctor, but it's not something I sit around thinking about because, you know, why would one? Why do I need to think about this, Judge?
Well, I mean, what about you, Gillian? Have you had any thoughts
about this rather gloomy subject? No,
just, do you think we ought to have done?
Well, I'll tell you that at the end, shall I? Not the very end, just the end of this episode.
What about you, Mark? Have you had any
No, again, quite deliberately. I don't want to think about it.
Paul?
No. Do we have to book it in advance or something else?
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. It's probably like Glastonbury tickets. You need to get in there now.
Jeremy, have you ever thought about this?
No, I've never thought about it at all.
Do you think we should have thought about it?
No.
Do you think the five of us have sabotaged your episode?
No, I don't think it's sabotaged. I think what you've demonstrated is, in fact, that we're all blinding ourselves to something that is a reality that we're going to have to confront in the future.
Have you confronted it?
I have sort of confronted it.
What do you mean,
I have made the necessary arrangements to ensure that if I fall into a coma or a persistent vegetative state or a minimally conscious state, that I am turned off, basically, and that no further treatment is afforded to keep me alive. So I have taken those steps, and I want my passing to be eased as much as possible.
Well, I totally agree with that, but that's not palliative care, is it?
Well, this is the point. There are misunderstandings about what palliative care is, and so that's why I'm going to introduce Dr. Sabrina Bajwa. Hello.
Hello.
Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
First of all, please do call me Sabrina. So I'm a palliative care consultant and I work at King's College Hospital. I'm also an academic, so I do research and I work at King's College London, the university.
I had my tonsils out at King's College Hospital. useful.
They're still there, probably. So most of us would understand palliative care to mean care for the terminally ill, but it's not as simple as that, is it?
So palliative care is specialised medical care for people living with a serious illness. So this type of care is focused on providing relief from the symptoms and stress of the illness. And the overall goal of the care that you receive from palliative care is to improve quality of life for both the patient and family. So palliative care is based on the needs of the patient, not on the prognosis. So it's appropriate at any age and at any stage in a serious illness. And it can be provided alongside curative treatment.
Right. What is the difference between palliative care and end-of-life or hospice care?
So the term palliative care is easily mistaken with end-of-life or hospice care, but they're not the same. Palliative care is not hospice or end-of-life care, but it can include both. So palliative care in itself is the ongoing care that, say, for example, people with Parkinson's and their families can have. You're planning for the future, addressing your symptoms and receiving an extra level of support. So end of life or hospice care is really for the last few months or year of life. And it's designated to really focus on end of life comfort, primarily through the relief of symptoms such as pain. And it's really focused on the last period of life.
Now, this podcast is, of course, about living with Parkinson's, and I suppose it ought to be also about dying with Parkinson's. But you have made a particular specialisation of the palliative care that is provided to seriously ill patients with Parkinson's, haven't you?
Yeah, as I mentioned, we have done some research at King's. We actually conducted the largest trial ever in neurological patients looking at delivering palliative care to these patients. And we recognise that palliative care for Parkinson's, the model of care that we use for other disease groups, say, for example, cancer, we shouldn't take that model of palliative care and really try to superimpose it on Parkinson's disease. And the symptoms, the needs, where there are some similarities, but actually Parkinson's disease is a unique disease in itself and we need to address the individual need.
Are you saying that we should have or could have palliative care for years and years and years then with Parkinson's?
So palliative care is partly to address symptoms, really. So you get many symptoms in Parkinson's disease. So specifically, palliative care would address the non-movement related symptoms.
Yes. You mentioned pain, for example.
Yeah.
It's a huge pain half the time.
People often are. Mm. And really, I think that what happens is that there are symptoms such as pain. You can get constipation. You can also get symptoms such as nausea as well. The other thing that does happen is people rarely have one disease. Recent research has shown that many of us in the population, as we get older, will have multiple diseases, comorbidities, and actually you could have four or five different comorbidities.
So what is the signal that tells us that we're going from what we've got at the moment, seeing our neurologist, if we're lucky, once or twice a year, to entering this different world?
I wouldn't really think about it as two separate worlds. I think if you have palliative care needs, and to talk about those palliative care needs would be helpful at this stage. So I would say those symptoms, if those are uncontrolled, if you have unmet emotional needs, for example, if you have depression or anxiety.
But that's about half the Parkinson's population.
It's true. It's awfully common.
It's not what most people think about as palliative care.
Yes, exactly.
It sounds like just like treatment. Yes. What's the difference between palliative care and treatment?
So palliative care runs alongside your treatment that you're getting from your neurologist, really. What we do in palliative care is take you as a person. So we don't just take the Parkinson's disease. We will think about the other diseases that you have and think about the symptoms that you have, say, perhaps from each of those diseases, and look at and examine how we can improve those symptoms.
So it's very personalised.
Yeah, individualised and personalised. And not just about you, it's about, you know, those that are important to you. So
that's an interesting question. How many of these patients with Parkinson's who are receiving palliative care involve their families?
When you have a palliative care assessment and you're seen by a palliative care specialist, one of the key things that we always insist on is that a family member or somebody that is close to you is present. And and that's because not only can you get a collaborative history, but also disease impacts those who are closest to you and they live through your disease journey. And it's important to understand how, one, they may benefit from extra help, but actually what's happening to them psychologically from a depression or anxiety perspective.
How is the referral for a palliative care assessment made?
So you can ask for a referral. So you can ask your neurology team to do a referral, but equally, you can go to your GP and ask for your GP to refer.
It would seem an extremely extremely strange thing to do, to say, I want palliative care.
But I mean, that's because there's a misunderstanding about what it means, isn't it?
I'm still confused about
this. Are the people who are having palliative care who don't need it at this moment, or who could retreat from that?
Is it a one-way street?
Yeah. Is it a one-way street?
No, it's not a one-way street. And often we will see patients and families, and actually then we'll go in and help improve their symptoms, optimise everything, do some advanced planning where we think about the future, and then actually things are okay and things are stable, and then we step back and then we can be re-referred, or you can ask for our help a year down the line or 2 years down the line. But it's really important, I think, to develop those relationships early, especially if you've got uncontrolled symptoms and issues, because then actually what you don't want to happen is to hit crisis point further down the line and try then.
It sounds to me as though everybody with Parkinson's should have a palliative care. And we're struggling to get enough neurologists at the moment. Is that what you're saying? That really, in an ideal world, everyone would have one, given it's a serious illness and we all have a wide range of symptoms?
Ideally, I would say that that would be the right answer. But, you know, we live in a world where there isn't enough funding. And I think one of the things that we found from our trial is that having a palliative care assessment did improve your symptoms and improved the quality of life for the patient and the carer. But actually, because we can't put a palliative care consultant and a palliative care nurse in every neurology clinic, one of the things that we've done is actually try to upskill some of the Parkinson's nurses and the Parkinson's teams, really, to help manage some of the basic symptoms, but actually also to recognise when a referral to palliative care is needed.
But does it come to this, that you would be seeking a referral to palliative care when your symptoms become intolerable?
If it was me, yes. I would seek a referral to palliative care when my symptoms impacted my quality of life.
But all the symptoms always
That's our story.
Yeah. And if I was quite depressed and then I was referred to palliative care, I become more depressed.
And I think that's because there is a misconception about palliative care, that it is a one-way street.
Yeah.
But Where does the word come from?
Cloak, it means.
Yeah. Cloak.
So there has been lots of conversations, I think, about changing what we're labelled as a speciality, and perhaps calling us supportive care. Mm. And that's fine. If you want to call us that, that's absolutely fine. I think
palliative has got a slight death row aspect. Yeah.
But also, where does the cloak business come from? Yeah.
I think it just cloaks you with care. That's what palliative is.
What's interesting about this is it kind of assumes that the care we get up until the palliative bit is not very good.
Or it's not holistic somehow, don't you think? Yeah.
That is the case, isn't it? Unfortunately, the way we deliver care within the NHS is very much that you go and see a speciality, you'll see a neurologist, or you'll see a respiratory consultant. And actually, when you go and do that, then those other diseases that you are experiencing, or if you're getting symptoms from other diseases, they're not addressed in the way that they should be. And I think one of the other things that palliative care does is, as well as looking after your symptoms, your physical symptoms and psychological symptoms, we do consider and talk to you about advanced care planning and thinking about what you want from your care, and helping you to really think about what is the most appropriate thing and what you see as the future. And in doing that, one of the things we do is help with communication with other people. Care is very much delivered in silos within the NHS, and having one team which overarches communicates with everybody is good.
Everybody you talk to who's got any sense knows that's the way forward, and the individual plan and the holistic care is the right approach. And yet it doesn't happen. Is that dust down to money, do you think, or is it attitude or changing the way the NHS does things possible even?
It's both. I think there is a lack of communication. I think we've got IT systems that do not communicate with each other, and everybody's working in silos. There's not enough money, or appointments are too short for people to have the headspace to deal with issues related to a different diagnosis. And I think that we're almost a one-stop shop where we look at you overall and importantly, not only just look at you, but look at your family as well and try to optimise everything to give you the best quality of life. Yes.
And is that a struggle when within the NHS? I mean, do you have to bang heads together getting a neurologist to talk to the diabetic specialist or whatever?
It doesn't happen smoothly.
Here's an even more gloomy point to be made. We heard on a previous episode that the rate of dementia for people with Parkinson's is 6 times that for the rest of the population. Are the majority of people receiving palliative care in the grips of dementia? And does palliative care differ if the patient is somebody with Parkinson's who's got dementia?
So I don't think the majority of people with Parkinson's that we see have dementia. I think there are a significant group because if you have Parkinson's and dementia, you are more likely to have more complicated symptoms and more complicated needs, and actually probably your family do as well. So we do see those patients, and I'm really glad that we see those patients. But equally, you know, we'll see patients who have cancer and dementia and COPD and dementia.
Yes.
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Yes. Yeah.
And when people come and see you, do you have to reassure them that this is not the end of the world? It might be one step on. Or...
So when I introduce myself, I will say I'm a palliative care consultant. Usually try not to be dressed in black. Exactly. But I am today.
I did think.
Yeah.
I did wonder.
But when I introduce myself, I say I'm here to try to have a look at your symptoms, to have a look at your pain or your breathlessness, and to make those as good as possible so that we can maximise your quality of life. And I will say as well that I'm not here because you're dying. I'm here because it's been recognised that we could perhaps improve those symptoms. Yes. And I think sometimes having that conversation really head on is important.
And how do you improve those symptoms?
You know, we mentioned about pain, really. Mm. I think pain is an important one because of the movement and you get stiffness in the joints. But I think alongside your neurological drugs, you can also have pain-relieving medications. And that's not just going down the route of thinking about morphine or something like that. You can get low-dose pain patches, which are really releasing painkiller over 72 hours, which help to take away some of that pain that you get. Talking about constipation as well.
Is there psychological assistance?
He doesn't like talking about constipation.
No. As soon as the C word comes up, I say, is there psychological assistance for depression, fear, and those aspects as one approaches the end?
I think that's really important. So as part of a palliative care assessment, we, as well as talking about the physical symptoms, we ask about, you know, how do you feel on a day-to-day basis? Do you feel low in mood? Do you feel anxious? And ask questions about how are you feeling about the future and what do you see the future holding? And the really important thing about asking those questions is actually those anxieties and those low moods and actually that fear about the future, which perhaps you can't voice to other people, may then come out. And actually unpicking what those fears are is really important.
We all know that one aspect or feature of Parkinson's is a lot of people experience a great deal of fear.
How do you deal with that? If you asked the question you asked and I said, yes, I'm really scared of dying, what do you say to that?
And I would say, I understand that, and I can completely understand why you feel like that. And then we'd explore it more for me to say, well, what do you see the future holding and what do you think is going to happen at the end? I think that's a really important conversation to have because yes. Some people think that it may go or end in a certain way and they've never been able to voice it and that scares them, or they have nightmares at night thinking about that. And actually what needs to happen if that's the case is actually you need to access the support, the psychological and counselling support that we have within palliative care to address those issues.
Can you really lessen the fear of something that is incredibly scary?
If you are scared about something and it may happen in the future and you can never completely say that it won't happen, actually what you need to do is you need to see somebody who has professional psychology experience to really get you to accept that it may happen, but how do you manage your everyday life and be able to go on a day-to-day basis and enjoy your everyday life? Part of that is CBT, so it's cognitive behavioral therapy, yes, and seeing a psychologist. And I think it's really...
Sabrina, there's no may about it. I mean, we all will ultimately shuffle off our mortal coil, won't we? I can see the point if it is a may, but if it's a will, then
it's just a how.
Carpe
diem.
Well, no, we will all die, but we don't all sit there scared of the fact that we are going to die and then not enjoying everyday life.
So some people are crippled by the fear of it.
They are. Can I ask you this final question? A friend of mine has seen a copy of his grandfather's death certificate, which says that the cause of death was Parkinson's disease. Can you in fact die from Parkinson's disease?
So you don't die from Parkinson's disease. What happens if you have Parkinson's disease is that you have signs or symptoms. So you can have things like postural instability, where you are more likely to fall over. So that can then lead to injury, which you could then die of. But also you can have problems swallowing. So what can happen is if that got particularly bad, then you could swallow some of your food and get an infection, and then you could die of that. But you don't actually die of the Parkinson's disease. And actually, the treatment for Parkinson's disease now, from a neurological perspective, is really very good. But I want to just stress really that palliative care isn't all doom and gloom. And I think that whilst it's there to help address some of these symptoms, and really it includes end of life, I think the aim of palliative care is really to maximise your quality of life all the time through your illness.
You need rebranding, don't you?
You do really need rebranding. Yeah. You definitely need rebranding. You need to drop the word palliative.
Call it positive care.
Positive extra care, you know, or something.
Extra is nice.
Well, anyhow, that's been extremely interesting discussion. And I thank you very much indeed. Our next guest is Lucy Tice. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, Nicholas.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself, please?
I'm a High Court judge. I've been a High Court judge for 13 years, appointed about 2 years, I think, after you were appointed. I'm Vice President of the Court of Protection and have been in that role since February of last year. And I'm also the lead judge in relation to applications under the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act 2008.
She sounds like more of a top judge than you, Judge.
Yeah, she's a top judge. Yes. But she's also seems to have done everything about human existence from the beginning, from soup to nuts. So can you just tell us, because this is relevant to the questions I'm going to ask you later, what does the Court of Protection actually do?
So the Court of Protection was a court that was set up in 2007 following the implementation of the Mental Capacity Act 2005. And it's there specifically to be able to implement the legal framework in relation to managing decisions for people who've lost their capacity.
So the Court of Protection makes welfare and financial decisions for people who have lost their mental capacity.
Yes.
How do you define loss of mental capacity? Is it just dementia or what is it?
Well, a person lacks capacity in relation to a matter if at the material time that the decision needs to be made, that they're unable to make it for themselves because of an impairment of or a disturbance of the functioning in the mind or brain.
And how do you judge that?
First, the impairment could be something like a psychiatric illness. It could be due to learning disability or dementia or because of a particular brain injury that's been caused either by a medical condition or by an accident.
But how do you determine whether somebody does or doesn't understand the information?
That is a matter of evidence in relation to the evidence that I will hear, but there will usually have been an assessment in relation to capacity by either a mental health social worker or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or other health professional.
Yes. Can I look at three particular arrangements that can be made, which perhaps would avoid litigation in the Court of Protection? That are firstly making a will,
yes.
Secondly a lasting power of attorney, and thirdly making what is called an advance decision. So I would like to discuss those three arrangements, which would have the consequence that you wouldn't have to litigate in the Court of Protection. How important is it to, while you have capacity, you make a will?
Really important. It is the easiest and the most straightforward thing to do, which we all probably have very good intentions to do at some point. But the sooner that it is done and the sooner there is a discussion with your partner, with your family, and to make arrangements is extremely important because it provides certainty, it reduces the risk of conflict, and it means that everybody is clear about
what
the position.
If you die without making a will, you die...
You die intestate.
Intestate, which is not good.
Well, it means that the intentions that you may have always wanted in relation to your estate may not be what actually happens.
Yes. And if you lose capacity, can you make a will?
There is provision for there to be a will that can be made by the court, but that's not straightforward.
A statutory and copy will.
Yes.
That would be made by the Court of Protection.
Yes.
So if you've lost capacity and your family thinks you should have made a will, you have to go to the Court of Protection.
Yes.
So this only serves to emphasise you really should make a will.
And does it count if you made a will on the back of an envelope and you just sign it and you...
There are
not.
Basic requirements for a will to be valid and to be able to be effective. Okay. So it's not advisable to do it on the back of an envelope.
Okay. Fair enough.
The Wills Act 1838, isn't it?
Do you ever get people saying, that isn't what I wanted at all?
Well, there obviously are circumstances where the court has to deal with, or it may be said that that was done under duress or under pressure, or that person didn't actually have capacity at the time that they made the will, and that's something the court will have to consider any applications about and whether it's established or not.
You're playing God.
That's what being a judge is about, Gerald. As we have found with our judge.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Somebody has to make a decision.
Somebody has to make a decision. So the next arrangement is a lasting power of attorney, which I think comes in two types, doesn't it?
So you can have a lasting power of attorney in relation to financial matters or in relation to health and welfare. In relation to health and welfare, it is what it says on the tin. It's to enable you to put in place arrangements so that if and when you do lose capacity, those arrangements are in place for somebody to help make decisions in relation to decisions for health and welfare on your behalf. And they will have been able to do that as your attorney, having had discussions with you, no doubt, about what sort of arrangements you would
want. And what if you think you have capacity, but you don't?
Well, then you don't.
You don't. At some point, so the health and welfare lasting power of attorney, you can enter into it now, obviously with capacity. You then apply for it to be registered with the Office of the Public Guardian. And once it is registered, it just sits there waiting. And then if you do lose capacity, it will then become effective. And you will either lose capacity as a result of an assessment having been undertaken by a doctor or a mental health social worker that you lack capacity. And then the system and the doctors will be able to accept that there is a valid lasting power of attorney in relation to health and welfare.
And this cuts out the Court of Protection.
And this cuts out uncertainty. And it enables you as somebody with capacity when you made that lasting power of attorney to be able to have some input in relation to decisions that may be made.
I've got this for both the financial and the health one. And I refer to it to my wife as this enables you to put me in a home when you get bored with me.
There's also the lasting power of attorney in relation to financial matters. And that is slightly different than the health and welfare one, because once it has been completed, and obviously in the process, there are safeguards to make sure that those who are completing lasting powers of attorney are not being put under any pressure, that they have capacity, and so there is provision for witnesses, etc., to be able to confirm that you have capacity and aren't under pressure. But in relation to the financial one, once it's been submitted to the Office of the Public Guardian and then it's registered, you can opt that it's possible to use it before you lose capacity.
Yes.
And so you may be able to have somebody within your family or somebody else who you trust to be able to assist you.
Pay bills.
To pay bills, to be able to be a third party who the bank can contact if there's concerns in relation to how you manage your account or your financial affairs.
I'm sure the professor's better at making financial decisions than you are. So,
well,
did she put you under pressure?
I can't remember. I just woke up and I had this thing in front of me which I signed.
Can I just say this one thing? It's very easy to execute these powers of attorney, but you must follow the steps exactly as they are set out at www.gov.uk power of attorney. And you must sign the documents in the right order, otherwise they're not valid.
Well, mine are all valid.
The guidance notes are very clear about, so you've just got to sit down and do it. It doesn't take a huge amount of time, but you just need to do it when you have time rather than under pressure. And it
Don't keep putting it off.
And it costs £82.
It's not much, no. The next thing I was going to ask, which is another very important step, in my opinion, that should be taken, is called an advanced decision, which in the old days used to be called a living will.
Well, this is where you can make, as it says on the tin, an advanced decision. If there, as Nicholas mentioned earlier, if there are particular circumstances that if you were in a minimally conscious state and you would then, if that was the situation you were in, you would want artificial nutrition and hydration to be withdrawn without any delay so that you would die as a consequence of that, you can set that out in an advanced decision. And there are safeguards in relation to that, that it's witnessed, etc., so that it's not done when it's
what it means is that you can, in the advanced decision, specify that treatment you might be receiving should be withheld or withdrawn. And if the doctors do that, they're exposed to no liability at all.
That's right.
This is a decision that you make, not the court of protection, not your attorney, that you are making while you have capacity to take effect when you've lost capacity and you're completely insensate. I just think it's really, really important that if that's what you want. Basically, it's a do not resuscitate if you fall into a vegetative state or minimally conscious state.
And I think it picks up on the point made by Sabrina earlier on about trying to, difficult though these decisions are, but talk about them in advance rather than at a time of crisis or when it's felt there's some kind of pressure. Because they're important decisions, and rather like the discussion you had about palliative care, they aren't discussions that you would normally have with your friends and family in advance of needing or having to consider that sort of thing.
Yes. Just one final point. If you've made an advanced decision and then you make subsequently a lasting power of attorney, then your advanced decision becomes invalid. So you've got to redo it after you've done the lasting power of attorney.
Or you can include also, there's a box in the lasting power of attorney if you want to set out any particular matters that you want taken into account.
Those are the three very important arrangements you've mentioned: will, lasting power of attorney, and advanced decision. And I'd just say that on our website, our sparkly new website, there is a blank version of the advanced decision there, or it will shortly be there. But you've been extremely interesting. Have you got any final advice for Parkies of a certain age?
Are there people who can help you do this if you need help?
In relation to the lasting power of attorney? Yes, you can do it through a solicitor or through the Citizens Advice Bureau or other organisations that will support
the judge,
you.
Judge will do it for you for nothing.
I will. Yeah, I'll help. I'll take you through it. Yes.
I think all I would say is that I think it is difficult but liberating to have those discussions sooner rather than later, both in relation to the lasting power of attorney, in relation to any advanced decisions, and if I may say so, in relation to a will, so that there is transparency within a family in relation to what's going to happen, because it's very difficult to know what is round the corner. I went to a memorial service recently where the son gave a very amusing eulogy. His father was a very serious accountant, and they had, as a standing joke within the family for many years, what was known as their father's death file. And it meant it was a file that was in his filing cabinet. And I think it had been in the family, known about for about 20 or 30 years. But he said it was absolutely fantastic that when the time came when his father did die, he said they opened this file and absolutely everything was there, very clearly set out. And he said what it did is it meant that we had time to be able to think about our father rather than worrying about whether there were any bank accounts, where they were and what they were. And I thought that was a really useful tip from somebody who'd really discussed that at a very early stage in his family.
Well, it's been an extremely interesting discussion, and I thank you very much for coming. You've taken actually some of your time on leave to come and be with us, for which I'm sure we're all extremely grateful.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
I'd just like to end this episode by reading from an email that I received today. It's from a colleague of mine, and he's talking about a friend of his who was diagnosed with Parkinson's last year and who's decided to retire. He says his friend is only 61. We'd lost touch somewhat, and so I didn't know how badly he'd been affected. And I wrote to him, and he said in his response, "Should you bump into Nick Mostyn, please tell him that Movers and Shakers has been a great help and comfort, especially in the early days."
Hear, hear.
It is very gratifying. He says precisely that. It must be very gratifying for you and your friends to know that what you're doing is really helping others. So on that happy note, we bring this episode to an end.
You've been listening to Movers and Shakers, a podcast about living with Parkinson's. The show is sponsored by Judge Nick Mostyn's Old Chambers and by the generous contributions of private donors. The show is produced by Nick Hilton for Poddo. Our theme music is by Alex Stubbs and cover artwork by Till Lucat. Please subscribe to get new episodes straight into your podcast app and do rate and review if you enjoyed the show. We have a brand new all-singing, all-dancing website with lots more information about each episode. You will find it at www.moversandshakerspodcast.com. And please email any thoughts or questions to feedback at moversandshakerspodcast.com. See you next week.